Hello, and welcome to another episode of the In Your Field podcast. Today I caught up with Stephen White. Stephen formerly worked for both Kerry Foods and Samworth Brothers, and inspired by his time working for these major food producers, in 2007 Stephen founded Quadex. Quadex is a business that helps food businesses to digitally transform food safety, new product development, customer care, and encourages sustainable and responsible sourcing. Stephen is a hugely knowledgeable and inspiring thought leader in supply chain risk management. We spent some time today discussing his love of farming, how we must learn from past mistakes, and how beer shortages can predict the future. Good morning, everybody, and thanks for joining us here on the In Your Field podcast today. I'm joined by Stephen White of Quadex, and it's over to you, Stephen. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and interest in all things rural and how it's influenced your life and your career?
Thank you, Anna, for inviting me onto this podcast. I was born on an Irish dairy farm, and you might pick that up in the accent. And I suppose my family, both my dad and now my brother, have been actively involved at board level in the farming cooperative movement in Ireland for over 50 years. I left the farm to work in the food industry because farming was too tough for me. And I've worked in two big food businesses that have had direct connections with farming. So Kerry Group in Ireland came out of a farmers cooperative and still is a large farmers cooperative. And latterly with Samworth Brothers here in Leicestershire. And Samworth Brothers have a big farming operation as well and have always been rooted in farming. And the Samworth family actually originated out of farming several hundred years ago into the food industry. I then set up Quadex in 2007, and Quadex now works with over 16,000 food and drink businesses globally, including a growing number of farmers within the supply chain. So we're doing a lot of work in one sector with a drinks business that has a lot of apple growers in their supply chain, for example. When I'm not working in Quadex, I switch off by going farming on my brother's farm in Ireland. So in recent years, I've actually started to get more actively involved again in the farming, and I'm investing a little bit in the farming, and in particular, in the agricultural contracting side of it. When I grew up on the farming, I didn't like milking cows. It was hard work. I preferred the tractors, but we couldn't afford nice tractors. I suppose now I can afford to spend a little bit on tractors, and I'm currently helping my 16-year-old nephew set up an agricultural contracting operation, and in fact bought him two tractors last week here in the UK, which we're in the process of shipping over to Ireland. So we're actually stuck in a Brexit-induced paperwork nightmare at the moment of phytosanitary certifications and steam cleaning tractors before we can take them to Ireland. So that's my rural background.
Very, very good. It sounds like hard work. And I know that farming is, and I think that that's one of the things that people quite often underestimate, how much hard work it is. But from your time with working with Kerry and Samworth Brothers in these big food producing businesses, what are some of the ongoing issues really that led to you founding Quadex?
The first was the inefficiencies caused by manual paper-based systems and spreadsheet or Excel-based systems, where businesses were running all of their food safety management systems using Excel spreadsheets and manual emails. So that was the inefficiency. The second was the identification and the need to use data better. To use data better to identify emerging risks and emerging issues within supply chains. And you cannot use data well if you're using manual systems. And finally, it was, again, using data to reduce the incidence of food recalls. So there are a lot of very expensive food recalls in the UK food industry that can be prevented using data and data analytics. So those were the main drivers for why we founded Quadex.
So really, I think we've all been through this last 12-month period, Stephen, maybe even longer than that.
18 now.
18 months, 2 years, isn't it, of this wonderful global pandemic that we find ourselves in. How do you think that that's affected the food industry in general? So food and drink sector, what's been happening?
I think there's been massive supply chain disruptions, which is making it very difficult for pretty much every food business to continue supplying orders. And you'll see in the media some of the things like CO2 shortages and HGV driver shortages, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. Every week when I'm speaking to customers in our customer base, they're having massive issues just getting ingredients into the factories or getting packaging into the factories or getting finished goods out to consumers. So that's been the one biggest thing. And the amount of unsung heroes from farmers through ingredient suppliers and producers, it's crazy the pressure people are under. And yeah, there's lots of public stuff around the shortage of labor, etc. Then the other big issue has been, there's been a lot of increases in costs. So costs of everything is going up. Ingredients, packaging, transport, CO2. Yeah. So farmers and food producers operate on razor thin margins, and they're having to absorb those costs and then try and pass those costs on. And that's ultimately, consumers are going to have to pay more for food, but generally speaking, consumers don't appreciate the food that they're getting and how cheap it actually is, and then resent the price going up. The other big impact has been, I think people have now realizing how fragile supply chains actually are. So everyone is taking supply chains for granted, but no one's taking supply chains for granted now following the disruption of the pandemic. And I think there is a general recognition and a realization that businesses need to understand their supply chains better and have greater visibility up through the tiers in their supply chain, because they're just used to placing an order with their direct tier one supplier and the goods being delivered a few days later. And they don't know what happens to get those goods into them until it goes wrong. So, yeah.
I'm veering away from the questions that I have written down here, really, because I think this is a nice point at which to kind of bring up the fact that we work with, so we've got around 8,000 rural businesses within our network now, with the Rural Business Group and Rural Business Awards. And I think that there is, like you say, there's a possibly, certainly with the public and even with some producers, there's a lack of understanding of what supply chains actually are, because until this point of this pandemic, when things have started to go wrong and people can't get hold of, you know, the last thing that my mum, bless her, tried to get and was horrified that she couldn't was corn flour. She was like, there's no corn flour anywhere. And we've seen the shelves in our big supermarkets kind of not stocking everything all the time. There was sort of minced beef shortages and things like that. And if you think, we produce these things in the UK, but we don't think about how they get from where they're, you know, that their source to our plates. And I think that's something that we're really keen to change and to shine a spotlight on, really, sort of from the farms, from the individual producers. So we're talking here a lot about food and drink. There are other supply chains as well, aren't there? So it's not just food and drink. Everything has a supply chain.
I think one of the challenges is everyone refers to supply chains and then creates this idea that it's a direct link from a farm to a pack house to a processing plant, and suddenly it's in a ready meal on the shelf. And that simplifies it. And it's not. It's a network. It's an ecosystem. It's a supply network, a supply ecosystem. And everything is interrelated. And it just needs one small part to fail, or just needs one company in the US to decide to shut down its fertilizer plants, two of them, because the price of gas has gone up, for the whole UK food industry to come within a few days of grinding to a halt. So it's an ecosystem. It's a network rather than a direct chain.
And it's a very fragile as well, like you say, using that example there. And I know that one of our old contacts, Shane, works for the Cold Chain Federation, I think it is. And I know I've followed him for some time now, and I've been I've been listening to him saying we're so close to failing this. So this will be the CO2 and the cooling, you know, systems and things like that. Our supply chains are so close to failing, but nobody seems to be interested until the point that it's actually too late and the failure is already in process.
Yeah,
you know, and then the knock-on effect is what affects the end consumers. So I think I do. I think it's incredibly important that we understand a little bit more about it and that we raise awareness of what supply chains are. We talk quite a lot as well about sustainability now, and, you know, trying to be a more sustainable country. I know that DEFRA are looking at and NFU are looking at, you know, keeping everything within the UK. So I think the figures are that we went from 80% production in the UK and consumption to down to 60%.
60%, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And I think that they've committed to try and keep us no lower to ensure that we don't go any lower than 60%. Is that a realistic goal, do you think? I'm totally putting you on the spot here because I've not even brought this one up. But do you think that's a realistic goal? And is it genuinely keeping everything within the UK? Or are those UK supply chains, and we talk about sustainably being British or whatever, do we still rely on outside influence for our supply chains? Or can we be truly self-sufficient?
No.
Simple answer.
We cannot be truly self-sufficient if we continue to expect to have things like out of season
avocados,
strawberries and avocados and stuff that we don't need. Yeah, and kiwi fruit, etc. But if we look at all the different challenges facing us, if we look at the climate crisis in particular and how we're going to become more sustainable, we're going to have to get more local. And we're going to have to source more locally because food miles and air freighting sugar snap peas from Africa is just bananas from a sustainability point of view. And could we do without sugar snap peas? I would argue, yes, I like them, but do we actually need them? Do we need our avocados? No. So potentially by needing to solve the climate crisis and reduce greenhouse gas emissions substantially very quickly. As a society, we're going to have to make more informed consumption decisions and have some sort of solution around carbon taxes or really reflecting the fact that if you're going to air freight stuff all over the world, there has to be such a premium price for it that it makes it so expensive that people are not buying avocados, they're buying carrots and onions. And so I think again, it comes back to the system. So by becoming more sustainable, we will have to become more local. And becoming more local, we will produce more food locally and in the UK.
Yeah. You know, it's something that I think that from a going back again to rural business perspective, I think, again, you know, you say we're talking about there's a lack of awareness of supply chains, but I think in general, there's a lack of awareness across the country of the impact that rural businesses have on everything.
Yeah.
Because we are, you know, we're the workhorses out here, certainly production-wise, producers, but also that there's lots of other things that rural businesses contribute that people just don't see. So correct. I think that it's very important that we include rural in discussions at high level with our government, with our policymakers, and everything else, really. Let me have a look at my questions again here, Stephen. I've got here. Yeah. What your thoughts really are on how rural businesses can start to champion and raise the profile of the contribution that they make. So obviously we're doing that as a group, but what do you think that our rural businesses, producers, suppliers can do to raise their profile and to make a difference and make a difference towards the sustainability targets and becoming carbon neutral by 2050?
I think the first thing to do is shout loudly and use social media to get the word out. Yeah. So I'm personally not a fan of social media. I don't use it. I'm not even on Facebook, but use Facebook, use all the various social media channels to put the word out there and spread the word about what local producers are doing. Then secondly, and this is going to be unpopular for some of your listeners, but I think, and again, coming from a farming background and having these debates with my brother pretty much on a weekly basis at the moment, we need to embrace regenerative agriculture and carbon sequestration, because there's a big opportunity there. But we need to make it clear that farmers need to receive the benefit of the sequestered carbon rather than the retailers and the brands. Mm-hmm. Or rather than DEFRA imposing new ways of working on the farmers, like they're trying to do at the moment with various schemes to replace single farm payments, but not rewarding farmers sufficiently for the public good that they're delivering. So I've seen some of the proposed payments that farmers are getting of, what is it, £70 per hectare, et cetera. What's the bloody point? That's just not going to give a farmer a return on changing their farming practices. There's a big opportunity for farming to sequester carbon and use regenerative agriculture to increase the carbon stock in the land. But the farmer should be and deserves to be paid for that. And that's the big challenge for NFU, for example, to get out in front of this and let the farmers earn that benefit. Yeah. And the farmers, in my vision, I would like to see farmers in 5-10 years time having another income source, which is selling carbon credits for the carbon that they've sequestered. But if we don't get out in front of that as a farming community, the retailers will mandate ways of working on their farming supply chains and then take the benefit and say how good they are and use what the farmers are doing to offset their carbon emissions. And the farmers, yet again, will be taken advantage of, in my opinion.
And I think that that's very true, because not only are you looking at the retailers that are wanting to take that, you've also got investors, people who are now very much into, and we should be, and this is not a bad thing, but into their corporate social responsibility, ESG commitments. In terms of big business, people are wanting to do something, but buying carbon credits and selling carbon credits at the point of it being for as an investment isn't doing anybody any good on the ground. And
it's tricky. I would challenge that, because what if you look at what's happening, for example, are you aware that Cargill in the US have come out in the last couple of weeks and they're now paying farmers $20 per ton to sequester carbon?
Right.
So by putting a value on that, it's not enough, but it's a starting point. Yeah.
So we think we can work with investors really and develop something that is more.
I think so, because it potentially, and investors are investors and there's lots of pros and cons. But if we can create a market value that says a ton of carbon sequestered in a field on a farm is worth £20 or £40 or whatever, and that farmer gets paid for delivering that ton of sequestered carbon, that is an income source to the farmer. Because my own gut feeling is if the market evolves, that the price of sequestered carbon credits will go up quite substantially. So what's £20 a ton today could be £200 a ton in 5 years' time, 10 years' time. And farmers could potentially make more money from sequestering carbon than growing wheat.
Yeah.
So... Yeah.
But we'll see how the market evolves, really. But
it's very, very tricky, because unless farmers and the farming community and the NFU get out in front of it, the farmers will be taken advantage of, is probably the best way of putting it.
Yeah. And it's the, just because it's not their thing doesn't mean that they don't have to be represented and, you know, to make the best of what's out there. And I agree that it's going to be a challenge over the next few years, really. So going back to Quadex a little bit and supply chain tracking and all things like that, as a small rural business, why might supply chain tracking be important to them, and how would a business benefit from what you do?
I suppose at the end of the day, we mainly serve bigger businesses, in the main. So, but for a small rural business, supply chain tracking, you're likely, the small rural business is likely to have a very short and local supply chain already.
Yeah.
Yeah. Therefore, it's actually quite easy to show this to consumers and justify earning a premium for locally sourced products.
So really,
we've got really cool software, but you don't really need, if you've got a farm shop or you're supplying product through a local farm shop, you can say, right, these jams were made here using fruit that came from here and using sugar that came from here. And that's so, and you can do that on a whiteboard or a chalkboard in the farm shop. And that's supply chain transparency. And that can be done locally with a bit of chalk and a chalkboard.
Yeah, and it's about the positioning, isn't it? So me being a marketer, it's actually about using that positioning and that for the benefit of your marketing, I suppose, and promote what it is that is good about it and that, get the positioning correct.
That's right. So you don't need big supply chain software like ours to make that information available, because you know your supply chain. It's about visualizing it and showing it to the consumer in a digestible format for the consumer to engage with. Then I think the other thing that we miss at rural businesses, we don't show how buying our products benefits other local businesses. And therefore, the what's called the local multiplier effect. And the fact that if the consumer buys from a local business, which buys from other local businesses, the whole local economy gets stronger. And that actually benefits the consumers as well, in more people moving into the area, house prices going up, etc. So everyone benefits from the local multiplier effect. Whereas if you use the example you gave earlier of a big global retailer and the product is coming from somewhere the other side of the world, most of the value is going the other side of the world as well. So it's less of a multiplier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and I suppose tell the story. We're not good at telling stories. I love visiting farm shops. Yeah. But we put product on the shelf that I know that's local, but there's no story. There's no romance. We're not playing to people's emotions. Yeah. And the end result, if we did romanticize the fact that it's local, play to people's emotions, we can justify the premiums that we're charging in the farm shop.
Yeah.
But the consumer feels good buying it, and therefore you end up with loyal repeat customers. Yeah. So I pay through the nose for local honey, because I think I have it on my porridge every morning. It's £6 or £7 a jar. Yeah. And I know I could go to a supermarket and buy cheap Chinese honey, but it's not the same. And so consumers will pay a premium if they believe there's a value in that premium.
Yeah, it's so that's, but I suppose that's what we're hoping to do, really, to get some more of these stories out there and just champion them, really. I think it's really incredibly important. Is there anything else that you want to add there around supply chains and things like that? Or shall we move on to my fun questions? Because I know we're a little short on time this morning.
Well, no, I'm fine for time, so I don't.
Okay.
Yeah. So no, I'm. Whatever. I think around.
Go on.
Around supply chains, I think we have a lot to learn, but we're not learning them.
Right.
We have a lot of lessons to learn, but we're not learning lessons. So, if you take the recent CO2 shortage. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know I mentioned that.
Explain earlier to people actually about the CO2 shortage, because some people might not be aware.
I think, I imagine everyone's aware of the press coverage that we were going to run out of fizzy drinks and meat, and the whole supply chain was going to come to a grinding halt, and we were going to starve because there was no CO2 in the UK last week. And the reason that happened was that 60% of the CO2, carbon dioxide, that's used across the food supply chain for food preservation in processing plants, etc., but is also used across the NHS, is also used in the nuclear industry, etc. CO2 is very, very widely used in a lot of different applications. But essentially, 60% of the CO2 that's produced and used in the United Kingdom comes from two plants that make fertilizers that are American-owned agricultural fertilizers. And the CO2 is a byproduct of the fertilizer production. In recent weeks, gas prices have gone up astronomically. Those fertilizer plants were no longer making money. So the American owner of the two fertilizer plants decided to shut down fertilizer production for a few weeks, and therefore CO2 production stopped. Yeah, so it was just a concentrated supply chain and no one understanding the risk, you say. And what has shocked me and disappointed me is you have all the media coverage about this big issue and what should we be doing about it. But actually, we had the same issue in 2018 during the World Cup. And no one, everyone seems to have forgotten that during in 2018, during the World Cup, there was a carbon dioxide shortage and we're going to have no beer during the World Cup. And like, it was going to be a crisis. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that. I think it was going to be pretty horrendous. But
yeah. We're going to have no beer during the World Cup. It's a crisis, serious crisis. But what shocked me is that the fact that no one learned in government or the regulators or DEFRA or any of these organizations from that issue that happened 4 years ago. Yeah. No, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And we've had the same issue again, and it's unexpected event, unexpected disruption in the supply chain. So everyone talks about what's called black swan events in supply chains. Mm-hmm. A black swan event is an unexpected event that no one could have anticipated. And therefore, we get caught out and we have problems. But let's be honest, we had this issue in 2018. We learned nothing from it. DEFRA, government, different departments. Yeah, I actually despair because business and industry are expected to manage everything, but they can't on their own.
There's no foresight, is there, or joined up thinking, or even crisis planning, I suppose.
But that's tricky because we do a lot of the Quadix software is mainly about risk management and risk assessing supply chains, and we do a huge amount of data analytics and alert businesses to potential risks. Yeah. And you're trying to look ahead and use horizon scanning to spot issues before they become an issue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's very hard to do horizon scanning well and look ahead because there's so much data. How do you make sense of it? But if we can't even learn from recent issues like 2018 and we have a repeat, I despair. I do despair. It's like the pandemic. The pandemic took us all by surprise. Yeah. But what I would say is in 10 years' time, we'll have another pandemic.
Yeah.
And we'll be in a mess again, and we won't have learned from this one. Yeah. So you may remember there was a horse meat issue in the industry about 10 years. We're coming up to a 10-year anniversary next year of the horse meat scandal.
Right.
Nothing's changed.
Really?
So there's been a few tick box exercises done, but fundamentally there will be another major food fraud adulteration incident in the next 2 or 3 years.
Nothing has fundamentally changed.
Yeah. So if we can't learn from big issues that hit us in the face, what chance have we of forecasting emerging issues?
That's interesting. And what would you? Whose responsibility is it to address these things? Is it a joint responsibility? And I suspect it probably is, but it has to be led from somewhere. So who should be challenging this and who should be leading it?
It has to be led by government. And we have government organizations like DEFRA, FSA, and this all sits under their mandate.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm not going to get into a political conversation.
Not today.
No. But these are national issues.
Yes.
And even if industry tried to solve the CO2 issue themselves, they'd straight away come up against competition issues. So you couldn't have the food industry, you couldn't have 10 or 15 of the biggest users of carbon dioxide in the food industry working together to mitigate this because it would be deemed to be anti-competitive.
Yeah.
So no, it is a government has to pick up the mantle. So I despair.
It is very complex. Let's just leave it at that, shall we? Finally, on supply chains, really. So for our slightly bigger rural producers, certainly food and drink businesses, and those that are probably getting to a size where they're thinking of supplying supermarkets or exporting, because we have had many of those joiners over the years start small and nicely grow. What simple steps can they be taking to develop more sustainable supply chains? What can they actually do?
Yeah. So the first is an easy one, is source locally, even if slightly more expensive. Yeah, as we discussed earlier. Second one, a little bit more difficult, but very achievable, which is remove all single-use, non-compostable packaging. Again, relatively easy to do, a little bit of on cost.
Yeah.
And finally, use the advantage of your rural location to embrace whichever green energy regeneration opportunities are best suitable to your site.
Right. That's
yeah, because rural businesses usually have a bit of space. So they can embrace solar or wind or ground source heat pumps or air source heat pumps, which can't be done in rural, in urban areas.
Yeah.
And what you'll find is each of those steps will make your business much more sustainable, particularly if you're in the premium product space, you're not competing on price, and they're easy to do.
Yeah.
And the business case is strong. You're not just taking a shot in the dark and hoping for the best.
Yeah, they're perfect. That's really helpful. Thank you, Stephen. Moving on to the fun ones now, I think. Now, and you probably had a little bit of time to think about these. So I tend to ask everybody, what's your favourite place in the UK to go and recharge your batteries? And if you say the farm in Ireland doing the work, you're a good man. Is it the farm?
It is, but that's not the UK.
Oh, sorry.
So being technically correct, answering your question, if I can't go to the farm in Ireland, Lake Windermere.
Really? Up in the lakes. Beautiful. Yeah. Away from it all.
Away from it all, yeah.
But with some nice little restaurants and coffee shops.
Yeah.
Now, this one might be a little bit of a busman's holiday for you, but if you were gifted 200 acres of land with an unrestricted budget and a remit to better people's lives, what would you do?
Very, very simple. I would maximize the usage of the farm for solar generation and wind generation, depending on the location. But there's a missed opportunity with a lot of solar farms are going on at the moment to elevate the solar panels up further off the ground. And I would use all of the farmland then for organic pork production, free range pork.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So you're basically using the advantage of the site to gain the sun and generate electricity, but your pigs can still graze the land and take shelter under the panels. Because budget is no option, I would set up my own pork processing facility on site. So the animal welfare would be top notch and convert all of the pork into premium pork products sold on the local farm shop. Mm-hmm. So you end up with premium, organic, local, carbon neutral pork. Yeah, because people will still need feeding even as we tackle the climate crisis.
Yeah. That's perfect. That's an interesting one. Thank you. We're moving on to books and podcasts. So the first thing is, have you got a favourite book or podcast for personal development? What do you like to read and listen to for developing your mind?
Stephen Covey, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
That's a good one.
Personal, yeah. And business. I'm sorry. It's equally applicable to business.
To both, so you can switch that around.
Yeah. So I've gifted a copy to all of my work colleagues over the years. If you follow it, for me, it's transformed my life personally and from a work point of view. Yeah,
I've not read that one. So
can't recommend it highly enough. It's you've got to persevere for the first 100 pages. It's a bit preachy, but after you've got through the first 100 pages and actually get into the 7 habits. It is life-changing, life-affirming.
So me being me, I'd skip the first 100 pages then and just jump straight into the habits.
You could, yeah. You could jump straight into the habits because too many people that I've given the book to have just lost the will to live at the 100 pages.
That would be me, unfortunately. But yes. And who is your hero, either in business or personally, or who has really inspired you on your journey?
My dad.
Your father. Hmm. Yeah. And he founded the farm, did he? Or is the farm?
No, he was a second generation farmer, but he was also actively involved in developing setting up two local farmers' cooperatives, one in the pork industry and one in the dairy industry. And my brother has carried on that now. So, because farmers working together in a cooperative can do amazing stuff. Okay, there's a lot of politics and stuff around co-ops as well. But generally speaking, I believe the cooperative model benefits farmers if you've got good governance.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you very much. It's been a delight to speak to you, Stephen, and I do hope that we get to catch up again
likewise
soon in a little bit more detail, perhaps. And I think we could do a lot more about supply chains and governance and sustainability with you for the group members. So thank you for your time today. I really appreciate you taking time to join us.
Not at all. Thank you for the invite.
You're very welcome.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining us for the In Your Field podcast. To make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe either via Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts.